All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry and I get to be your host today. We've got a great program about World War I coming up, so we want you to stay tuned. We've got a couple of announcements that we want to make also. A couple of weeks ago we did a program on the burn pits of Iraq and Afghanistan, and a documentary was made about this and we talked about it on the program. And we're going to be showing this documentary here locally in the Ann Arbor area. And I just wanted to let you know where and when, because this is being sponsored by Legal Help for Veterans. We all know about them here on Veterans Radio. But The Burn Pits, a free documentary, explores the toxic exposure and effects of the burn pits in Afghanistan and Iraq. It's entitled Delay, Deny, and Hope You Die. Some of us who have talked about veterans' benefits in the past have heard that one before when you're working with the VA sometimes. It seems that way. Delay, deny, and hope you die. But these are going to be shown at the Phoenix Theaters. It's coming up in Livonia on Monday, November 6th at 2 o'clock and 7 o'clock at the Phoenix Theater in Livonia. It's going to be at the Phoenix Theater in Wayne on Tuesday, November 7th, the same times, 2 and 7. And then on Wednesday, it's going to be at the Phoenix Theater in Monroe, Michigan, November 8th, from 2 till 7. For more information, you can go to phoenixmovies.net. Tickets are available at the theaters on a first-come, first-served basis. I think it's really important that you take the time to go and see this one. It's something that we feel is such an important topic. It's almost like it's the Agent Orange mystery of the Iraq-Afghanistan wars. These are things that men and women have been exposed to, that the military wasn't sure probably that there was going to be harm that might have been perpetrated on them by these. But it looks like it might be. So they're seeming to have ending up having a lot of respiratory issues especially. So the burn pits, again, Delay, Deny, and Hope You Die is going to be at the Phoenix Theaters in Livonia, Michigan, Wayne, Michigan, and Monroe, Michigan, starting on Monday, November 6th in Livonia, Tuesday, November 7th in Wayne, and Wednesday, November 8th in Monroe. Hope you get an opportunity to check that out. Another piece of information that I thought was kind of interesting, since on the 8th of November, is also a fundraiser here in Ann Arbor, Michigan, for the Fisher House of Michigan. And the Fisher House, as many of you may know, is a sort of like a Ronald McDonald's house for the VA. And Michigan does not have a Fisher House at this time, and we're hoping to build one here in Ann Arbor. And so we've been raising funds, and we've been approved by the Fisher House across the country, the Fisher House Foundation, so they provide matching funds, so we're trying to raise money for this, and our next upcoming event is on the 8th of November as well, and this is going to be at Hill Auditorium, and it's called Stories of Service, and this is an event that they had last year, and they have five or six different veterans from different eras tell their stories, and it's a really fascinating event, and it's going to be, as I mentioned, at Hill Auditorium on Wednesday, November the 8th. The doors open at 6:30. The program begins at 7 o'clock, and they've got five veterans, as I mentioned, telling their stories. It is free. Of course, there's a catch here. They really would like for you to make a donation. And if it's anything like last year, there was an organization that stepped forward and said that they would match any money that was made on that evening. So I'm hoping that they will be able to do that. So you want to reserve your tickets, though. It is free, but you need to reserve your tickets. So you need to go to storiesofservice.org, and you can get your tickets from there. If you want to be part of the VIP reception, this is only by invitation only, you probably should contact Fisher House of Michigan, and I'm sure that you may get an invite to that, and that's going to be up in the fancy part of Hill Auditorium up there. It's sponsored by the U of M Veteran and Military Services there. So there's going to be storytelling, music, great cause, honor our veterans. Last year it was really a great program, and I'm sure that it will be again this year. As I mentioned, we have our veterans coming from Iraq, World War II, Vietnam, Korea, and so forth. So that's, mark your calendars. If you don't go to the movies on Wednesday, November 8th in the afternoon. You can do that, and then you can drive back up to Ann Arbor and go to Stories of Service at Hill Auditorium. Doors open at 6:30. For more information, go to storiesofservice.org. I hope you can make it. All right. Wow, I didn't even get a chance to introduce myself. I'm kind of discombobulated tonight. My name is Dale Thronberry, and I am your host this evening. And we are going to be talking with Dennis, can't pronounce your name here, Skupansky. And he is the, he does a lot of things that deals with the World War I Centennial Commission, not only here in Michigan, across the country, but especially out in the Grass Lake area where he has got a little museum that he started up out there, the Michigan Military Heritage Museum. And so we're going to be talking about that after the break. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, you can by giving us a call at 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. Or you can call us toll-free, 734-838-1600. You can follow us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter. Some of you probably are listening through our website, so hopefully you'd like to get some feedback by that. I know, I have a contest here. Somebody send me an email, and hopefully that you are the farthest away listener to the program today. How about that? And if I get to hear from you in the next week, I have a nice book about the best of Veterans Radio that I can send out to you. Just send that to Veterans Radio at P.O. Box 3085, Ann Arbor, Michigan, 48106. Or you can send an email to me at dale@veteransradio.net. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the World War I centennial. Who knew, right? So stay tuned. You're listening to Veterans Radio. And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're going to be talking about World War I today because it is the 100th anniversary of our American involvement in World War I, and there's a lot of things going on across the country. There's a national World War I commission, and there's also a local World War I commission, and there's also a local connection here to that, and that is our guest today, and that is Dennis Skupansky. From Grass Lake, Michigan. He is part of the Grass Lakes Area Historical Connection program out there, and he runs a museum that has a pretty good display of World War I paraphernalia, let's put it that way. So, Dennis, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, welcome, Dale.
And so tell me, I got this idea because I got an email from somebody about your museum. And in fact, a bunch of local Vietnam veterans went out to beautiful downtown Grass Lake for breakfast last week, and I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't show up at your museum after they had breakfast. And I had been out there almost a year ago now, I guess it was around Veterans Day, and it's a great little museum you've got there. How did you get started with that?
Well, actually, I'm more involved with the World War I Centennial, but Scott Gurich, who's a Grass Lake resident, started this idea about 10 years ago because there was a number of people who were doing reenacting, and they thought it was a shame that veterans would be, just throwing away military uniforms and stuff. So they wanted to form a museum somewhere where they could preserve all these things and tell the story of Michigan's service people. And so it wasn't until about 3 years ago that they actually started getting ideas and getting enough money where they could actually get a building. Mm-hmm. And so last November they opened a building, and that's, and I brought some of my stuff in because I live actually in Ann Arbor. So I was involved in World War One stuff. So I brought it out because of the centennial, and Scott liked the idea. So we set up some displays for the World War One centennial. Mm-hmm. Plus we have other displays there about Michigan service people. And actually now we even got Michigan service animals because they've got we're going to have in November some speakers coming out, and one of them is going to be about the War Dog Memorial out in South Lyon, and we're going to have someone talk about that. So not only do we have men, women, but now we also have animals out there.
Well, yeah, we did a story here on Veterans Radio about the War Dog Memorial up there at the intersection of Milford and 11 Mile.
Yeah.
That's another place, a great opportunity. If you guys like to do road trips like my wife and I like to do on Sundays, it seems like getting in the car and ride. to check out some of these local museums. You know, they're not huge, but they're very, very important, and they're very interesting too. And I was really taken by the museum that's out there in Grass Lake. So let's talk a little bit about the World War I Centennial Commission. And I know that you had something that you wanted to make sure that we got into it. So, Dennis, go ahead.
Okay, well, one of the things I want to do is just explain what the mission of the World War I Centennial Commission is. It's to plan, develop, and execute programs, projects, and activities to commemorate the centennial of the World War I, encourage private organizations and state and local governments to organize and participate in activities organized by the commission, facilitate and coordinate World War I Centennial activities throughout the state, serve as a clearinghouse for collection and dissemination of information about World War I Centennial events and plans, and develop recommendations on ways to commemorate the World War I Centennial in this state and provide a report on these recommendations to the director and the governor and the legislature. And so basically the commission has already been approved by and the governor signed it. So now the only thing we're waiting for is the governor to announce who's going to be on Michigan's World War I Centennial Commission. Mm-hmm. And that should be coming any day now.
Well, we hope so, because the way government seems to run, it might not get the commission filled until it's over. But I think what's interesting is, and I'm sure that, World War I is kind of the war that nobody knows anything about anymore, because it is 100 years ago and no survivors anymore after, I believe his name was Frank something.
Right.
The last one to pass away. So it's important that we do find out how we got involved, because this really was the war that put us on the world stage.
Correct. Yeah, one of the things that I find interesting about the First World War, it really changed Michigan. Because before the First World War, Michigan's economy was agricultural, forestry, and mining.
Mm-hmm.
And during the teens and the early 20s, it changed to manufacturing and engineering. And during the First World War, we really had an opportunity not only to show Michigan and the United States and the world what we could do as far as engineering and manufacturing, but then we took all these, the best and the brightest from Michigan, and sent them over to France, and they were involved. Like one of the units I have on Michigan's World War I Centennial website is about Michigan's 16th Engineers. They were Michigan's only all-volunteer regiment, and they were formed up of all volunteers who went over real early in the war. They were over in August of 1917 in France, and their job was to develop the infrastructure for the American Expeditionary Force. And so this group had a chance to really showcase Michigan's engineering mm-hmm. People. And they had one of the people in charge of it was Colonel George Webb, who was responsible for the largest construction project of the U.S. Army in France, which was called the Nevers Cutoff, which is basically a railway line that avoided the city of Nevers and cut through and made a shortcut to the front line. And it mm-hmm. saves them about 10 miles and about probably 5 hours of train time.
Okay. Well, there are so many characters that we talked about before we went on the air that I want to make sure that we get to all of them. But I want to give you a little background to our audience, because I don't think people knew how involved that we actually were in World War I, because before the draft was initiated, it was an all-volunteer force. And it said that during World War I, Michigan contributed over 135,000 men and women and had over 5,000 casualties. But it wasn't just the war effort, not the servicemen and women. It was, as you just mentioned, it was its engineering and manufacturing capability. I mean, this is kind of like everything coming together here, because you've got Henry Ford with his assembly mm-hmm. line, and you've got all the other things that were happening in Michigan as far as industrial change was going on. Yeah. And so I think, this was kind of the beginning of the arsenal for democracy, even though they didn't call it that.
Right. Well, just to let you know, there's a gentleman from the East Point Museum, Michigan's Military Historical and Technical Society, Chris Cosley. He's doing presentations on a dress rehearsal for the Arsenal of Democracy, and it's all about during the First World War in Michigan, all the companies and all the manufacturing that was done for the war effort, such as mm-hmm. Ford Motor Company, General Motors, Fisher Aero Plane Division, Grand Rapids Aeroplane Company, there was a number of companies in Michigan that started manufacturing things, and though it only lasted 18 months, 19 months, but by the time it came for World War II in 1940, the American government knew where they could turn to produce everything, mm-hmm. all the war goods, because they already did this in World War I, even though most of the stuff never got over to France. But we had that. We showed them that capability to engineer and manufacture things. And so that was this. And he does a real good talk on, say, the dress rehearsal for the Arsenal of Democracy, which something a lot of people know about what we did in World War II, mm-hmm. but they don't know what was going on in World War I. And one of the things I like to talk about with that is, since I'm also involved with the Yankee Air Museum, is Rosie the Riveter. Mm-hmm. And one question I ask when I'm doing presentations is, was Rosie an orphan? And the answer is no. Her mother was working in Fisher Body Aeroplane Division in Detroit, right off 75 and Springwells, and then also in Grand Rapids. They had 13 furniture companies combined to form the Grand Rapids Airplane Company, which produced Hadley Page bombers. And so they, because they was made, all made out of wood, they had the best people there to do that. And they had both of these companies employ somewhere around 5,000-6,000 women. Okay. So women were actively involved in the airplane industry before mm-hmm. before World War II. In fact, they used to have what's known as vestibule classes, where they take women who would normally, you know, were doing domestic jobs, and they wanted to train them how to work in a factory, because originally they sent a couple women into the factory and they'd have one of these guys, burly chested guys, mm-hmm. smoking cigars, blowing smoke into their faces, and they had the loud machinery, and it was dark. Well, what they did is they wanted women to work in these factories and do things, so they took them out to like the lobby of the building where it was lighter, quieter, and they had one of the more gentler foremen show the women how to do the job out there mm-hmm. amongst themselves, and they could talk about it. Once they felt confident doing that, then they could move them into the factory, and they already knew how to do the job, and now they could just block out all the noise and all the other stuff going on. And so this was a real interesting phenomenon, how they brought women into the workforce.
That is interesting. I don't think that, again, something we don't know about World War I, because we know about Rosie the Riveter. I mean, they just had this big
world record
yeah. gathering of Rosie the Riveters over at the Yankee Air Museum over at Eastern Michigan. Actually, I think it was over 3,700.
Yep, 3,755.
3,755. And a lot of people that we know were involved in that. And, you know, the Facebook lit up with all these pictures of grandmothers and granddaughters and great-granddaughters all dressed up as Rosie the Riveter. So, I mean, it's a very big story here in Michigan, and I'm really happy that we're able to get this out to people in talking about World War I, because the contribution that Michigan made to that. And I know that we were talking before that, you know, there were so many characters that were involved in it. In fact, in addition to your 16th engineers that you mentioned, there were a number of volunteer hospital groups that went over.
Right, there was two.
And since you built the website, I suppose you already know about these.
Yeah. Yeah, there was two volunteer organizations, and they were set up by the Red Cross, because the Army at the time didn't have the management, the facilities, the organization to have medical facilities. So the Red Cross organized volunteer hospitals. One was Base Hospital 17, which is out of Harper Hospital, now part of Detroit Medical Center, mm-hmm. and the other was Base Hospital 36 from Detroit College of Surgery and Medicine, which is now Wayne State Medical School. And so these organizations were volunteer organizations. The hospitals set these organizations up, and they solicited individuals for money. Mm-hmm. And Base Hospital 17 from Harper Hospital was set up in the fall of 1916, because they were expected to go down to the Mexican border. But when that ended, they were ready to go to France, and they shipped to France in July of 1917. Base Hospital 36 was organized in April of 1917, just after declaration of war. And because mm-hmm. we were able to raise money so fast from a number of large contributions from Detroit businessmen, they went out and bought the best medical supplies for X-rays and laboratory equipment. And so when they were organized and it went over to France, they were the first 1,000-bed hospital. And so they were okay. one of the best hospitals over in France at the time. They went over in November of 1917.
Okay. Well, that's again, it's another thing that, you know, that Michigan has added and contributed to the war effort during World War One, and we're talking with Dennis Shapansky here. At some point, maybe on the Michigan World War One Commemorative Commission, but I see he's by his shirt he's a member of the World War One Historical Association, and he's an expert on this, and he's involved with a whole bunch of different organizations here in Michigan to talk about our involvement in the World War One Commemorative Society and what's going on and so forth. And so, if you have any questions here for Dennis, you can give us a call here on Veterans Radio at 734-822-1600, 734-822-1600. All right, well, let's talk a little bit more about some of these people that were involved, as you mentioned. One guy that I thought was interesting, and I've got to find my paperwork here, signed up with the French. And you mentioned that this happened to quite a few people along the way.
Right. A number of them, people from Michigan, either went over to Canada or England, or else they signed up with the French and because they wanted to get involved with the war before, you know, the United States was involved. So is it probably Fred Zinn? Probably
yeah,
near
that's
the
guy.
End. Yeah, from Kalamazoo.
The pilot.
I think it's from Kalamazoo, if I'm not mistaken.
Where did he go?
Or maybe it was Battle Creek. He should be the last.
He
should be the last guy there.
Patriot, innovator, aviator, politician, humanitarian. So mm-hmm. Tell me about Fred Zinn.
Well, Fred was in the French Air Corps, and one of the things he was famous for or developed with was aerial photography and looking at the ground things. But later in his life, he was really wanted to make sure that we saved or could rescue American downed pilots. And so in World War II, he became famous for that with the search and rescue stuff. And so that was probably his lasting contribution.
Mm-hmm.
But he was, if you go to Michigan, if you go to ww1cc.org/Michigan, you'll be able to read all about these different people we're talking
mm-hmm.
about. And you can see pictures of them. So it's something, you know, once again, ww1cc.org/Michigan. That's the Michigan's World War One Centennial website. We've got all these stories about some of these great Michiganders and what their contributions were to the war and afterwards. And say Fred is a really interesting guy because, say, he was with the French Army and with the Air Corps. He signed up with the French Foreign Legion mm-hmm. and served as an infantryman, then got into the Air Corps. And once the United States was in the war, he was became with the U.S. Air Corps. And say it was a big thing in World War II with the downed pilots. So,
well, it's fascinating to read about him. It says Frederick Zinn was a native of Galesburg, Michigan, graduated from the University of Michigan in 1914, and set out to tour Europe. He arrived just as the Great War broke out. He joined the French Foreign Legion and fought in several vicious campaigns before transferring to the French Air Service. He was a member of the illustrious Lafayette Flying Corps, and his former Legionnaire comrades served in such squadrons as the Lafayette Escadrille. When America joined the war, he transferred to General Billy Mitchell, and we've all heard about Billy Mitchell as far as aviation is concerned. So he was there right at the beginning.
Oh, yeah. He was an interesting character. And that's one of the things why we want people to know about this, because right now, as far as Michigan's World War One Centennial, if you ask people, they'll know about perhaps the Polar Bear Unit, the American Northwestern Expeditionary Force, and 32nd Division, which is the National Guard Division made up of half of Michigan, half Wisconsin National Guardsmen. And then you don't get much else after that.
I don't know how much they cover in schools anymore about World War One, especially local mm-hmm. History of World War One. We got about 2 minutes before we have to take a break, Dennis. So, let's talk about the Michigan Medal of Honor recipient.
Okay.
From World War One, and that's Harold Furlong.
Okay. Yeah, he was was a rather interesting person because at the end of the war he became a doctor and was working up in Pontiac, and it was sort of interesting how someone who could win Congressional Medal of Honor would then get into, you know, become a doctor. Is like, it's sort of two mm-hmm. different things. But in his younger life, he was a war hero. He was over in France and, you know, in battle. And, you know, he did, he probably didn't think it was a big deal. But, you know, when you read about it on the website, you'll see it was, you know, under fire and he saved
right.
people. And
said his company was held up by severe machine gun fire from the front, which killed his company commander and several soldiers. So suddenly he's in charge. said he moved out in advance of the line with great courage and coolness, crossing an open space several hundred yards wide, taking up a position behind the line of the machine gun, closed on them one at a time, killing a number of the enemy with his rifle, putting four machine gun nests out of action and driving 20 German prisoners into our lines. I served in the Army National Guard up until May of 1946 afterward and was honorably discharged as a lieutenant colonel.
And it was just an interesting person because he was the only one from Michigan to win the Congressional Medal of Honor. We have a number of people who won Distinguished Service Cross, Distinguished Service Medal, but for Congressional Medal of Honor, we only have one.
Well, no. It's not an easy one to earn, and not necessarily everybody wants to earn it. In fact, we're going to be playing one from World War One. Unfortunately, I didn't have this name beforehand, but it's not Harold Furlong, but it's another World War One person. We do a Medal of Honor recipient every week from different conflicts and stuff, and I always try to put them into the conflict that we happen to be talking about on that particular day. So we are going to be taking a break here for the news. We're talking with Dennis Spansky here about World War One. Centennial Commission / Michigan, and how we are celebrating the beginning and the endings of World War One. So stay tuned. We'll be right back after the news. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Back on Veterans Radio, and my name is Dale Thronberry, and I am your host today, and we're talking all about World War One. So we want to make sure that you get in on the conversation. Maybe you have a question. Maybe you have a relative who served in World War One. We're trying to find out as many things as we can about Michiganders who served during World War One, and I'm sure that our guest, Dennis Shapansky, would love to talk to you about if you had any relative during World War One. The number here is 734-822-1600, or you can send me an email at dale@veteransradio.net, and we'll get some more information before we get off the air if you wanted to contact Dennis as we go along. So, Dennis, we've been talking a little bit about these unusual people, not unusual people, but the heroic people from the state of Michigan, and you wanted to talk about one who seemed to be involved almost in inventing the Internet.
Yes, Major General George Owen Square from Dryden, Michigan. He was a West Point graduate, and then he was stationed in Baltimore, and he managed to switch some time off with some of the other officers and got a PhD from Johns Hopkins and patented multiplexing,
What is multiplexing?
Multiplexing is the ability to send multiple signals over a copper wire, such as during World War One, the United States had the most advanced signal system because we only needed one line of wire to send Morse code or else to send telecommunications, where everybody else had to use two lines because they had one for voice and one for Morse code.
Okay.
And so that's what multiplexing is. And in the development of the Internet, it's sort of like you have Samuel Morse sending text messages. Then you have Alexander Graham Bell with voice, General Square developing multiplexing. Then in the 60s, you have the Defense Department's linking computers together, and then you have Bill Gates with his software stuff making it available for everyone. Mm-hmm. So when you look at the development of the Internet, I call him the grandfather of the Internet because he wasn't, the end of it, but if it wasn't for his scientific, discoveries and stuff, we wouldn't be able to do this, sending multiple signals over the existing wires.
I know I always talk to people about I teach a mass media class, and one of the questions I always try to get my students to understand. I said, put yourself back 100 years, which of course is impossible for them to do, and imagine that you're just hearing voice through a wire or a Morse code through a wire and you're not being able to see them. You're landlocked. I mean, you can't just walk around with your cell phone and do whatever it is. And these inventions just kind of piled on top of each other so quickly. And we look at how fast things are changing today, and it's really the same thing. I think this guy is pretty fascinating, and he had a lot to do, as you mentioned, with the telecommunications of the time, But he also had this young woman that worked with him.
Okay.
And who is that? Can we go to her?
Sure. Olita Jure.
Yeah.
And
Olita.
she was what's known as a hello girl. She lived over in right on the St. Clair River. Her family came over from Canada. They were French Canadians. And so during World War One, General Square was the chief signal officer. So his responsibility was for all the signal communications, the United States, and also the American Expeditionary Force. And what they found out in France was that the American telephone operators and stuff couldn't speak, most of them couldn't speak French, and the American telecommunication system went through the French phone lines. So what Pershing asked for was to get some people that could speak French. So what they did is they scoured the phone companies, Michigan Bell Telephone Company is one of them, and they found women who could speak, were fluent in English and French. And usually these weren't just line operators, they were supervisors. And so they found these women, put them in the, well, they didn't put them in the military because that's another story at the end of it.
Right.
But they were in the Signal Corps, and they were trained on how to work on the systems and sent over to France so that if someone in the front lines was calling in for artillery or whatever they needed, it would go to the hello girls, which were they always, that's how they got their name, because mm-hmm. they said, hello, this is so-and-so. Mm-hmm. And so the American soldiers loved to hear the American women
sure.
talk. And then these operators would then connect them through the French phone system because they could speak French. And apparently it was a real tough job because the French phone system is, the operators there aren't really cooperative. But that was their job, and they worked it over there in France for the American headquarters and other, in fact, some of them were right up near the front lines doing, mm-hmm. working communication things. And Olita Jure is really interesting because when she went over, she knew how to sing and dance and play piano, and so they were stuck on a ship when they went to England because there was an outbreak of the flu. And so she was there with the Red Cross entertaining the troops, and the Red Cross actually tried to get her to become part of their entertainment group
okay.
instead of becoming just with a hello girl.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've got a storyteller who now goes out and does the Olita Jure story. So if you're interested in having something like that in your library or your school, you can look that up. If you go to Michigan's World War I Centennial website, we've got some information. Just send me an email. I can put you in touch with the person who does that.
That would be a pretty cool thing to really bring somebody in like that into
yes,
a classroom,
it is.
Especially for high school kids.
Yeah, you get a chance to see because she dresses up in the uniform and comes in and gives you a performance so you actually feel like you're part of it and you know what mm-hmm. sort of the life of what it was like to be a woman, a telecommunications operator back then. And one other thing I was going to add to the story was that even though they were under Army regulations, at the end of the war, these women were told they were not actually part of the Army and couldn't get veterans benefits or veteran status. And it wasn't until the late 70s when they were finally recognized. And then that's when they finally started getting benefits and they could start wearing, you know, they got a victory medal and things mm-hmm. like that. So it was really a thing where, I mean, it took them like, what, 50 years, 60
right.
years to get recognized as being part of the Army. And they when they were over there, they thought they were part of the Army the whole time.
Well,
so.
We heard the same thing in World War II. There were, you know, the women pilots
right.
that were, you know, working and said, oh, no, you're not really in the military. And it probably occurred about the same time that they got notified.
There was a lot of
right.
Congressional wheel and dealing going mm-hmm. on about that because the women were upset because they thought they were part of the military. And then mm-hmm. they find out that, well, yeah, you were under regulations and stuff, and you could be court-martialed, but when it came time for the benefits, they're told they weren't.
Right. Well, you know, there wasn't a lot of benefits. You know, one quick aside, and just because I guess we're dating this program, though, is that there was a guy named Tillinghast Houston, who was from Michigan.
Well, actually, he's from New York, but right. he served with the 16th Engineers.
Okay.
And so he was a coal owner of the New York Yankees and responsible for getting Babe Ruth onto the New York Yankees. And so it was interesting when I talked to one of his relatives about he was with in Detroit in the spring of 1917 when the 16th Engineers were training out the Michigan State Fairgrounds. And one Sunday afternoon after the boys had a Sunday afternoon off, some of them came in and were, well, they enjoyed it a little bit too much. And so he made them drill until they were sober. and apparently from when I talked to his relative, he liked drinking whiskey and he had a real colorful language.
I guess so. What is interesting, as you mentioned, is that he's associated with the Yankees, and, you know, the hated Yankees in most cases out in this part of the world. But it is interesting. He said he was a co-owner with Jacob Rupert, and I remember that name when I was growing up on the East Coast.
And he was about 50 years old when he became a captain, a company commander in the 16th Engineers. So you can imagine, I mean, 50 years old, and you're going out there doing stuff with – well, the 16th Engineers were a little bit older. Their average age was about 28, and the regular Army was about 20, 22. But still, to be 50 years old and going out doing things is a little bit,
Can't even imagine that. One thing for those of you out there that pay attention to dollar signs, he sold his share of the New York Yankees to Rupert for $1.5 million. What are the Yankees worth today? I do not know, but that's kind of interesting. All right, let's go. Moving right along. Let's talk about Major General Harry Hill Bandholtz.
Yeah, who was he? He was from Constantine, Michigan, which is in the west part near Kalamazoo. And he was a West Point graduate, and he was with the Army out in the Philippines. And one of the interesting things about him before we get into his World War One service was that he was in the Veterans of the Philippines, and he was responsible for the actually part of the formation of the Veteran of Foreign Wars, because he got the Veterans of the Philippines along with the Spanish War veterans and stuff to combine their organization and form the VFW.
So
he was instrumental in that way with the veterans organizations. And so then when he was in the Philippines, he was made a colonel and then eventually made a general and as a temporary rank. And he was responsible for putting down some insurrections. And one of the things he did was he marched into several villages about six times and sought out the rebel leader and sat down and talked to him and managed to get the rebel leader to surrender his arms, surrender his people, and say and the insurrection in a number of different communities. And he'd say he did this about six times. And, I mean, talk about brave. Was normally when people, a military officer would walk in, I mean, they'd shoot him or hang him or something. And he managed to walk out about five or six times with the whole group. And, I mean, he was a real diplomat.
Plus, he spoke Spanish, right?
Yes, he did. And so then the thing, he was working with a number of the generals in World War One, and that's where General Pershing learned about him, because he was responsible for also the constabulary force in the Philippines. So during World War One, he was made the provost marshal over in France, because the United States military was experiencing a number of thefts. And also, when you've got 2 million people over there, you're going to have a few bad apples. So he was basically known as the father of the military police, because he started schools to train people on how to become policemen, because he realized you couldn't just take an Army private and put an MP badge on him and tell him, okay, go be your police officer. So he sought out people that were in police and regular and civilian life and started training the other soldiers on how to become military police. And after the war, he was with the Hungarian peace delegation in 1919. And one of the issues they had was with the Romanians. The Romanians thought that since part of Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Hungary part of it, was given to them, that they should also get their share of the National Museum treasures. Well, they had a revolving president for the country of Hungary, which is set up between the United States, France, and Great Britain. And this day, when they wanted to raid the museum, the Romanians wanted to raid the museum, General Bandholtz was in charge. And so he ran down there with his riding crop and another officer who drove him down. And he managed to put some tape across the doors and took a U.S. censor stamp and stamp it because he knew they respected official seals, and stood there with his riding crop and told them that they weren't going to be looting this museum. And the Hungarian people were really, really appreciated that, and his riding crop is in the Hungarian National Museum, and also they have a statue of him in Budapest outside the U.S. Embassy. And they took that down after World War II when the Soviets took over, but then once the Soviet Union was breaking up, they brought it back out again out of storage, and now it's back up in Budapest. And he's one of the few American generals I know that are in Eastern Europe that have a statue.
I would say that's an interesting story. I mean, these guys from Michigan and women from Michigan did some great things during World War One. I think it's fascinating, and I certainly appreciate the effort that you've gone through in talking and writing all these things down. I mean, that's got to be a lot of things. There's a couple of other characters. There's one character I wanted to bring up just recently because we all suffer from the Detroit Lions. And this guy's name is George M. Potsy Clark. Can you tell me about Potsy a little bit?
Yeah, he served in the Army during World War One, and he became the coach of the Lions in the mid-1930s. And that was when the Lions won their first championship. Mm-hmm. And so it was interesting that he was, you know, that the Lions actually were good at one time in their career. You know, so back in the mid-30s, George Potsy Clark, a World War One veteran, they went in. He went, you know, through college. He was coaching in college, and then he went on and became the, say, Detroit Lions coach and actually won some championships in the mid-1930s. And at the time, Detroit Lions were one of the best teams in the National Football League. And if you want to read the whole story, yeah, go to www.1cc.org/Michigan and look under bios, and they've got the whole story probably takes about 10 minutes to read. So, but at least there's some interesting people on there.
It's fascinating. Was there, and also there were a number of World War One veterans who turned out to be governors.
Right. Yep. Colonel Harry Burgess was in charge of the 16th Engineers from Detroit. Detroit's only all volunteer regiment. He was the chief engineer in Detroit for the waterways, and so he was responsible with inland waterways. That was a specialty, and so he was in charge of navigation along the Detroit River and the Great Lakes. And they've got a monument, not to him, but on Belle Isle, the northern, well, I guess it'd be the eastern point, but there's a marble lighthouse, and it's for, that's the only marble lighthouse in North America, and it's for Colonel Livingstone, who was one of the bankers in Detroit who worked with Colonel Burgess as far as navigation, when they had a navigation committee, mm-hmm. and Colonel Burgess was part of the engineering staff from the Army Engineers, and Henry Livingstone started the Dime Bank, and his job was part of the civilian organization to work with the engineers on that navigation. And so the monument or the lighthouse on Belle Isle is named after Colonel Livingstone, who was made an honorary colonel of the 16th Engineers because of his contributions, and also his son served with the regiment.
Okay. So we got Colonel Burgess. Wait a second. Let me see if I can find my other.
Oh, you want Carl Detzer? Carl Detzer was an interesting character. He was born in Fort Wayne and was a newspaper man. And he served with the Indiana National Guard down on the Mexican border. And he used to write back to the Indiana or Fort Wayne newspapers about his experiences. And so when he came back, he was became a beat writer in Fort Wayne. And there was a case of Cyrus McCormick's jewelry he gave to his wife was stolen, and he solved the case for Pinkerton Security Company in Chicago. And so he went over to France with the Indiana National Guard, and near the end of the war, the United States was experiencing a large amount of thefts, and so they were looking for someone to basically become an undercover agent. And they asked the Pinkerton Company if they would be in charge of training people and hiring people to do this. And he says, you don't need me. You've got Carl Detzer. He saw the Cyrus McCormick jewelry case. He's your best man over there. So he became in charge of the Le Mans district, which is a district about the size of Illinois. And what was happening was the French black market criminals would get with U.S. deserters from the army. And the deserters knew where the U.S. stuff was, and they also knew how to fire the .45 automatic pistol. And they didn't have a problem using it on American soldiers. And so his first 100 days, he solved 100 murders, and that was one of his claims of fame. But he was stopping probably like $10,000 worth of robberies a day. And what would happen was these American deserters would go in and steal stuff from warehouses, from trucks, or trains, and then present them to the French black marketeers, who then would sell it and make a profit. And there was a lot of money being made by these groups. And so the Carl Detzer's job, the Division of Criminal Investigation, was to go out and stop this from going on. And he did that. And he has on the website, it shows his actual pass that he has. And it says that he can go anywhere And he can be in military uniform or civilian uniform. And if there's, and if he needs help, you're supposed to help him. And at the end of the war, he was charged with, he was, had a court-martial because a number of the prisoners were saying that he was cruel to them. But when they, during the court-martial, came out that these, all these, not just the criminals, but also a number of people in the army were upset with him because he was solving all these cases. And there was a number of their friends that happened to have sticky fingers, and he was busting them. And a lot of times they didn't get demoted, but they were just shipped back to the United States, you know, real quick. And so just to protect their reputation. So he managed the court-martial was found that was when people testified, they found that the charges were false against Carl Desser. Mm-hmm. And he went on in World War II to become Marshall's basic fireman. So General Marshall, whenever there's any kind of supply issues or administrative issues, would send Carl Desser to solve them. So he went to France, went to the Middle East, Italy, and he was, say, the fireman for General Marshall's during World War II.
Oh, another great Michigander there.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about the Khaki Trio just real quickly.
Okay, there was during World War I, they didn't have a USO organization. Mm-hmm. So what they did was the Red Cross would bring Americans over from New York and entertain the troops. Well, they also found that there's a number of people in the military who had talents, and one of them was Charles Forsythe from Lawrence, Michigan. Mm-hmm. And him and his brother and Dusty Rhodes formed the Khaki Trio. And so they toured Europe, entertaining U.S. and Canadian and British troops, and they were a singing group. And if you want to hear one of their songs, if you go to the, say, www.1cc.org/Michigan, under videos, you'll see it, and it's called, was it Hail to the Boys in Khaki?
Oops. Yeah, I think it was.
Hold yeah, on. So it's, or Here's to the Boys
Here's
in Khaki.
Here's to the Boys in Khaki.
Here's to the Boys in Khaki, and it's performed by the Dugouts. And it's a real interesting song, so it's that's the only known recording that we have, and was made back in April at the Michigan Military Heritage Museum.
Oh, okay. Let's see. Tell me about Eugene Van Antwerp.
Okay, Eugene Van Antwerp was working
about 5 minutes ago
for the Michigan Central Railroad, and when war was declared, he became a lieutenant with the 16th Engineers, and then after the war, he was a longtime city councilman. He was also involved in the veterans organization, and in 1940, he was mayor of Detroit just before Mayor Coble. He served one term. But while he was in the mid-30s, he was the national commander for the VFW, and in 36, he was responsible for lobbying a number of congressmen, senators, and also governors to pass legislation to make Armistice Day or Veterans Day, now November 11th, a national holiday. And if it wasn't for him, we wouldn't have a national holiday as Armistice Day, which then after World War II in Korea, they changed to Veterans Day. And there's a large Van Antwerp family out there because I contacted some of them. And it's one of these things, they got like Van Antwerp Park in Detroit and stuff. So it's, he's really an interesting person. He had like 10 kids.
Again, another interesting mission. Where's the guy? I want to find out about the guy from Boeing. Where did he go?
You want to know about John Houston or John Hudson Poole.
Right.
He was a West Pointer from 1903, and his father was a colonel in the Civil War from Wisconsin, and he was stationed at Fort Wayne. And so he went through West Point and graduated in 1903, and then he decided to stay in Detroit. And he married a woman named Caroline Bowling, whose father came over from Germany, was an engineer, and he made a huge fortune. He was one of the Detroit's richest people. And so he had a daughter named Caroline who married John Hudson Poole. And then he also had a son named William who a lot of times went to Switzerland for school. And then he went out west and got involved with the lumber industry, and then he got involved with aviation, and now there's, you know, the Boeing aircraft company. So that was his fame. But his sister married an officer from the 16th Engineers, and he was responsible for – ran the Gray Motor Corporation, which employed another individual named Lawrence Hammond, who was famous because of the Hammond organ. But he also had 110 patents, which dealt with – 3D technology. He was working in during World War II as a civilian. He was working on infrared technology, development of basically a Sidewinder missile. And so he was another guy in the 16th Engineers. In fact, interesting story about the Lawrence Hammond was that when he was growing up, he spent a lot of time in France because his father committed suicide and his mother took him and his sister to France.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so when the United States went to war with the 16th Engineers, they couldn't ship all the supplies they needed over to France. So Lawrence Hammond, because he could speak French, was sent out to get local supplies such as nails, wood, and things like that. And he was stopping for dinner one time, and he was talking with a French general who was going to have him arrested because he said, Americans don't speak that good French. And so he said, well, anybody can get an American uniform. You're just a deserter from the French army. And it wasn't until his chauffeur came in and picked him up that the French general realized that, yes, this was an American, and he wasn't a French deserter.
Oh, okay. So French, they don't like it when people don't speak their language well. Trust me, I know that. So we have Boeing there. How about Nurse Frances Reed Elliott Davis? This is, I thought, was an interesting story as well.
Right. She was from North Carolina.
2 minutes.
And she was the first black nurse to get certified by the American Red Cross. And she spent most of her life during World War I down in North Carolina. Then she went to school in New York and Washington, D.C., and became went through college and got herself a nursing degree. And finally, the Red Cross during the war made her a nurse, and it was they put an A after the end of her certificate, so everybody knew she wasn't a regular nurse. She was an African American nurse, and so they didn't let her go overseas. But then after the war, she moved up to Michigan and lived in Inkster and lived in Detroit too, and was involved with the African American medicine in Detroit, the city, and then moved out to Inkster and was responsible for a number of the projects out there. In fact, Eleanor Roosevelt, just before World War II, came out there, and they've opened up a family center in Inkster, Michigan.
Oh, okay. Well, as we said earlier, time flies when we're having fun, and the hour is over, Dennis, and I want to thank you so very much for being on Veterans Radio today. Where can people go, real quickly again, to read these stories and find out more about what the commission is up to?
Okay, you can go to ww1cc.org/Michigan, and we do a monthly video called Michigan's World War I Centennial News Report, and there's about 70 of them. So if you don't want to read, you just want to sit back and watch them, you can just watch the videos, or you can go to the website, the Michigan State Centennial website, and you can, you know, look up anything you need to about World War I, and there's also an email, so if you want to contact me and have questions, feel free.
Okay, we got to go. Thank you. Walking Encyclopedia. Thank you very much, Dennis. You've been listening to us on Veterans Radio. We'll be back next week. You are dismissed.